fear the Yankees or Frank Kennedy's men would return and take her. Even little Wade had his duties. Every morning he went out importantly with a basket to pick up twigs and chips to start the fires with. It was the Fontaine boys, the first of the county men home from the war, who brought the news of the surrender. Alex, who still had boots, was walking, and Tony, barefooted, was riding on the bare back of a mule. Tony always managed to get the best of things in that family. They were swarthier than ever from 4 years' exposure to sun and storm, thinner, more wiry, and the wild black beards they brought back from the war made them seem like strangers. On their way to Mimosa and eager for home, they only stopped a moment at Terra to kiss the girls and give them news of the surrender. It was all over, they said, all finished, and they didn't seem to care much or want to talk about it. All they wanted to know was whether Mimosa had been burned. On the way south from Atlanta, they had passed chimney after chimney where the homes of friends had stood, and it seemed almost too much to hope that their own house had been spared. They sighed with relief at the welcome news and laughed, slapping their thighs when Scarlett told them of Sally's wild ride and how neatly she had cleared their hedge. "She's a spunky girl," said Tony. "And it's rotten luck for her, Joe getting killed." "You all got any chewing tobacco, Scarlett?"
"Nothing but rabbit tobacco. Pa smokes it in a corn cob."
"I haven't fallen that low yet," said Tony. "But I'll probably come to it."
"Is Dimity Monroe all right?" asked Alex, eagerly but a little embarrassed. And Scarlett recalled vaguely that he had been sweet on Sally's younger sister.
"Oh, yes. She's living with her aunt over in Fayetteville now. You know their house in Lovejoy was burned, and the rest of her folks are in Macon."
"What he means is, has Dimity married some brave colonel in the Home Guard?" jeered Tony, and Alex turned furious eyes upon him.
"Of course she isn't married," said Scarlett, amused.
"Maybe it would be better if she had," said Alex gloomily. "How the hell—" "I beg your pardon, Scarlett.
But how can a man ask a girl to marry him when his darkies are all freed and his stock gone and he hasn't got a cent in his pockets?"
"You know that wouldn't bother Dimity," said Scarlett.
She could afford to be loyal to Dimity and say nice things about her, for Alex Fontaine had never been one of her own beaux.
"Hell's afire. Well, I beg your pardon again. I'll have to quit swearing or Grandma will sure tan my hide. I'm not asking any girl to marry a pauper. It mightn't bother her, but it would bother me."
While Scarlett talked to the boys on the front porch, Melanie, Sue Ellen, and Corrine slipped silently into the house as soon as they heard the news of the surrender. After the boys had gone, cutting across the back fields of Tara toward home, Scarlett went inside and heard the girls sobbing together on the sofa in Ellen's little office. It was all over. The bright, beautiful dream they had loved and hoped for, the cause which had taken their friends, lovers, husbands, and beggared their families, the cause they had thought could never fall, had fallen forever. But for Scarlett, there were no tears. In the first moment, when she heard the news, she thought, "Thank God! Now the cow won't be stolen. Now the horse is safe. Now we can take the silver out of the well, and everybody can have a knife and fork. Now I won't be afraid to drive round the country looking for something to eat." What a relief! Never again would she start in fear at the sound of hooves. Never again would she wake in the dark nights, holding her breath to listen, wondering if it were reality or only a dream that she heard in the yard, the rattle of bits, the stamping of hooves, and the harsh crying of orders by the Yankees. And best of all, Tara was safe. Now her worst nightmare would never come true. Now she would never have to stand on the lawn and see smoke billowing from the beloved house,
and hear the roar of flames as the roof fell in. Yes, the cause was dead, but war had always seemed foolish to her, and peace was better. She had never stood starry-eyed when the stars and bars ran up a pole or felt cold chills when Dixie sounded. She had not been sustained through privations, the sickening duties of nursing, the fears of the siege and the hunger of the last few months, by the fanatic glow which made all these things endurable to others, if only the cause prospered. It was all over and done with, and she was not going to cry about it. All over. The war which had seemed so endless, the war which, unbidden and unwanted, had cut her life in two, had made so clean a cleavage that it was difficult to remember those other carefree days. She could look back, unmoved, at the pretty scarlet with her fragile green morocco slippers and her flounces fragrant with lavender. But she wondered if she could be that same girl. Scarlet O'Hara, with a county at her feet, 100 slaves to do her bidding, the wealth of Terra like a wall behind her, and doting parents anxious to grant any desire of her heart. Spoiled, careless Scarlet, who had never known an ungratified wish except where Ashley was concerned. Somewhere, on the long road that wound through those 4 years, the girl with her sachet and dancing slippers had slipped away, and there was left a woman with sharp green eyes, who counted pennies and turned her hands to many menial tasks. A woman to whom nothing was left from the wreckage, except the indestructible red earth on which she stood. As she stood in the hall, listening to the girl's sobbing, her mind was busy. "We'll plant more cotton, lots more. I'll send Pork to Macon tomorrow to buy more seed. Now the Yankees won't burn it, and our troops won't need it. Good Lord, cotton ought to go sky high this fall." She went into the little office, and disregarding the weeping girls on the sofa, seated herself at the secretary and picked up a quill to balance the cost of more cotton seed against her remaining cash. "The war is over," she thought. And suddenly she dropped the quill as a wild happiness flooded her. The war was over, and Ashley, if Ashley was alive, he'd be coming home. She wondered if Melanie, in the midst of mourning for the lost cause, had thought of this. "Soon we'll get a letter. No, not a letter. We can't get letters, but soon. Oh, somehow he'll let us know." But the days passed into weeks, and there was no news from Ashley. The mail service in the South was uncertain, and in the rural districts there was none at all. Occasionally, a passing traveller from Atlanta brought a note from Aunt Pitty, tearfully begging the girls to come back. But never news of Ashley. After the surrender, an ever-present feud over the horse smoldered between Scarlet and Sue Ellen. Now that there was no danger of Yankees, Sue Ellen wanted to go calling on the neighbors. Lonely and missing the happy sociability of the old days, Sue Ellen longed to visit friends, if for no other reason than to assure herself that the rest of the county was as bad off as Terra. But Scarlet was adamant. The horse was for work. To drag logs from the woods, to plow, and for Pork to ride in search of food. On Sundays he had earned the right to graze in the pasture and rest. If Sue Ellen wanted to go visiting, she could go afoot. Before the last year, Sue Ellen had never walked 100 yards in her life, and this prospect was anything but pleasing. So she stayed at home, and nagged, and cried, and said once too often, "Oh, if only Mother was here!" At that, Scarlet gave her the long-promised slap, hitting her so hard it knocked her screaming to the bed and caused great consternation throughout the house. Thereafter,
Sue Ellen whined the less, at least in Scarlett's presence. Scarlett spoke truthfully when she said she wanted the horse to rest, but that was only half of the truth. The other half was that she had paid one round of calls on the county in the first month after the surrender, and the sight of old friends and old plantations had shaken her courage more than she liked to admit. The Fontaines had fared best of any, thanks to Sally's hard ride, but it was flourishing only by comparison with the desperate situation of the other neighbors. Grandma Fontaine had never completely recovered from the heart attack she had the day she led the others in beating out the flames and saving the house. Old Dr. Fontaine was convalescing slowly from an amputated arm. Alex and Tony were turning awkward hands to plows and hoe handles. They leaned over the fence rail to shake hands with Scarlett when she called, and they laughed at her rickety wagon, their black eyes bitter, for they were laughing at themselves as well as her. She asked to buy seed corn from them, and they promised it, and fell to discussing farm problems. They had 12 chickens, 2 cows, 5 hogs, and the mule they brought home from the war. One of the hogs had just died, and they were worried about losing the others. At hearing such serious words about hogs from these ex-dandies who had never given life a more serious thought than which cravat was most fashionable, Scarlett laughed. And this time her laugh was bitter, too. They had all made her welcome at Mimosa, and had insisted on giving, not selling, her the seed corn. The quick Fontaine tempers flared when she put a greenback on the table, and they flatly refused payment. Scarlett took the corn and privately slipped a dollar bill into Sally's hand. Sally looked like a different person from the girl who had greeted her 8 months before, when Scarlett first came home to Tara. Then she had been pale and sad, but there had been a buoyancy about her. Now that buoyancy had gone, as if the surrender had taken all hope from her. "Scarlett," she whispered as she clutched the bill, "what was the good of it all? Why did we ever fight? Oh, my poor Joe. Oh, my poor baby." "I don't know why we fought, and I don't care," said Scarlett. "And I'm not interested. I never was interested. War is a man's business, not a woman's. All I'm interested in now is a good cotton crop. Now take this dollar and buy little Joe a dress. God knows he needs it. I'm not going to rob you of your corn, for all Alex and Tony's politeness." The boys followed her to the wagon and assisted her in, courtly for all their rags, gay with a volatile Fontaine gaiety, but with a picture of their destitution in her eyes. She shivered as she drove away from Mimosa. She was so tired of poverty and pinching. What a pleasure it would be to know people who were rich and not worried as to where the next meal was coming from. Kate Calvert was at home at Pine Bloom, and as Scarlett came up the steps of the old house in which she had danced so often in happier days, she saw that death was in his face. He was emaciated, and he coughed as he lay in an easy chair in the sunshine with a shawl across his knees. But his face lit up when he saw her. Just a little cold which had settled in his chest, he said, trying to rise to greet her. Got it from sleeping so much in the rain. But it would be gone soon, and then he'd lend a hand in the work. Kathleen Calvert, who came out of the house at the sound of voices, met Scarlett's eyes above her brother's head, and in them Scarlett read knowledge and bitter despair. Cade might not know, but Kathleen knew. Pine Bloom looked straggly and overgrown with weeds. Seedling pines were beginning to show in the fields, and the house was sagging and untidy. Kathleen was thin and taut. The two of them, with their Yankee stepmother, their 4 little half-sisters, and Hilton, the Yankee overseer, remained in the silent, oddly echoing house. Scarlett had never liked Hilton, any more than she liked their own overseer, Jonas Wilkerson, and she liked him even less now, as he sauntered forward and greeted her like an equal.
Formerly, he had the same combination of servility and impertinence which Wilkerson possessed, but now, with Mr. Calvert and Rayford dead in the war and Cade sick, he had dropped all servility. The second Mrs. Calvert had never known how to compel respect from Negro servants, and it was not to be expected that she could get it from a white man.
"Mr. Hilton has been so kind about staying with us through these difficult times," said Mrs. Calvert nervously, casting quick glances at her silent stepdaughter. "Very kind. I suppose you heard how he saved our house twice when Sherman was here. I'm sure I don't know how we would have managed without him, with no money, and Cade..."
A flush went over Cade's white face, and Kathleen's long lashes veiled her eyes as her mouth hardened. Scarlett knew their souls were writhing in helpless rage at being under obligations to their Yankee overseer. Mrs. Calvert seemed ready to weep. She had somehow made a blunder. She was always blundering. She just couldn't understand Southerners, for all that she had lived in Georgia 20 years. She never knew what not to say to her stepchildren, and no matter what she said or did, they were always so exquisitely polite to her. Silently she vowed she would go north to her own people, taking her children with her, and leave these puzzling, stiff-necked strangers. After these visits, Scarlett had no desire to see the Tarletons. Now that the four boys were gone, the house burned and the family cramped in the overseer's cottage, she could not bring herself to go. But Sue Ellen and Corrine begged, and Melanie said it would be unneighborly not to call and welcome Mr. Tarleton back from the war. So one Sunday they went. This was the worst of all. As they drove up by the ruins of the house, they saw Beatrice Tarleton dressed in a worn riding habit, a crop under her arm, sitting on the top rail of the fence about the paddock, staring moodily at nothing. Beside her perched the bow-legged little Negro who had trained her horses, and he looked as glum as his mistress. The paddock, once full of frolicking colts and placid brood mares, was empty now except for one mule, the mule Mr. Tarleton had ridden home from the surrender. "I swear I don't know what to do with myself now that my darlings are gone," said Mrs. Tarleton, climbing down from the fence. A stranger might have thought she spoke of her four dead sons, but the girls from Terra knew her horses were in her mind. "All my beautiful horses dead. And, oh, my poor Nelly. If I just had Nelly, and nothing but a damned mule on the place. A damned mule," she repeated, looking indignantly at the scrawny beast. "It's an insult to the memory of my blooded darlings to have a mule in their paddock. Mules are misbegotten, unnatural critters, and it ought to be illegal to breed them." Jim Tarleton, completely disguised by a bushy beard, came out of the overseer's house to welcome and kiss the girls, and his four red-haired daughters in mended dresses streamed out behind him, tripping over the dozen black and tan hounds which ran barking to the door at the sound of strange voices. There was an air of studied and determined cheerfulness about the whole family, which brought a colder chill to Scarlett's bones than the bitterness of mimosa or the deathly brooding of pine bloom. The Tarletons insisted that the girls stay for dinner, saying they had so few guests these days and wanted to hear all the news. Scarlett didn't want to linger, for the atmosphere oppressed her. But Melanie and her two sisters were anxious for a longer visit, so the four stayed for dinner and ate sparingly of the side meat and dried peas which were served them. There was laughter about the skimpy fare, and the Tarleton girls giggled as they told of makeshifts for clothes, as if they were telling the most amusing of jokes. Melanie met them halfway, surprising Scarlett with her unexpected vivacity as she told of trials at Terra, making light of hardships. Scarlett could hardly speak at all. The room seemed so empty without the four great Tarleton boys, lounging and smoking and teasing.
And if it seemed empty to her, what must it seem to the Tarletons, who were offering a smiling front to their neighbors? Corinne had said little during the meal, but when it was over, she slipped over to Mrs. Tarleton's side and whispered something. Mrs. Tarleton's face changed, and the brittle smile left her lips as she put her arm around Corinne's slender waist. They left the room, and Scarlett, who felt she could not endure the house another minute, followed them. They went down the path to the garden, and Scarlett saw they were going toward the burying ground. Well, she couldn't go back to the house now. It would seem too rude. But what on earth did Corinne mean dragging Mrs. Tarleton out to the boys' graves when Beatrice was trying so hard to be brave? There were two new marble markers in the brick-enclosed lot under the funereal cedars. So new that no rain had splashed them with red dust. "We got them last week," said Mrs. Tarleton proudly. "Mr. Tarleton went to Macon and brought them home in the wagon." Tombstones! And what they must have cost! Suddenly, Scarlett didn't feel as sorry for the Tarletons as she had at first. Anybody who would waste precious money on tombstones when food was so dear, so almost unattainable, didn't deserve sympathy. And there were several lines carved on each of the stones. The more carving, the more money. The whole family must be crazy. And it had cost money, too, to bring the three boys' bodies home. They had never found Boyd or any trace of him. Between the graves of Brent and Stuart was a stone which read, "They were lovely and pleasant in their lives, and in their death they were not divided." On the other stone were the names of Boyd and Tom, with something in Latin which began, "Dulce et..." But it meant nothing to Scarlett, who had managed to evade Latin at the Fayetteville Academy. All that money for tombstones! Why, they were fools! She felt as indignant as if her own money had been squandered. Corinne's eyes were shining oddly. "I think it's lovely," she whispered, pointing to the first stone. Corinne would think it lovely. Anything sentimental stirred her. "Yes," said Mrs. Tarleton, and her voice was soft. "We thought it very fitting. They died almost at the same time. Stuart first, and then Brent, who caught up the flag he dropped." As the girls drove back to Tara, Scarlett was silent for a while, thinking of what she had seen in the various homes, remembering against her will the county in its glory, with visitors at all the big houses and money plentiful, Negroes crowding the quarters, and the well-tended fields glorious with cotton. "In another year, there'll be little pines all over these fields," she thought. And looking toward the encircling forest, she shuddered. "Without the darkies, it will be all we can do to keep body and soul together. Nobody can run a big plantation without darkies. And lots of the fields won't be cultivated at all, and the woods will take over the fields again. Nobody can plant much cotton. And what will we do then? What will become of country folks? Town folks can manage somehow. They've always managed. But we country folks will go back 100 years, like the pioneers who had little cabins and just scratched a few acres, and barely existed. No," she thought grimly. "Tara isn't going to be like that. Not even if I have to plow myself. This whole section, this whole state can go back to woods if it wants to, but I won't let Tara go. And I don't intend to waste my money on tombstones or my time crying about the war. We can make out somehow. I know we could make out somehow if the men weren't all dead. Losing the darkies isn't the worst part about this. It's the loss of the men. The young men." She thought again of the four Tarletons and Joe Fontaine, of Rayford Calvert and the Monroe brothers, and all the boys from Fayetteville and Jonesboro whose names she had read on the casualty lists. If there were just enough men left, we could manage somehow, but... Another thought struck her. Suppose she wanted to marry again. Of course, she didn't want to marry again. Once was certainly enough. Besides, the only man she'd ever wanted was Ashley, and he was married, if he was still living. But suppose she should want to marry. Who would there be to marry her? The thought was appalling. "Melly," she said, "what's going to happen to Southern girls?"
"What do you mean?"
"Just what I say. What's going to happen to them? There's no one to marry them. Why, Melly, with all the boys dead, there'll be thousands of girls all over the South who'll die old maids."
"And never have any children," added Melanie, to whom this was the most important thing.
Evidently, the thought wasn't new to Sue Ellen, who sat in the back of the wagon, for she suddenly began to cry. She hadn't heard from Frank Kennedy since Christmas. She didn't know if the lack of mail service was the cause, or if he had merely trifled with her affections and then forgotten her. Or maybe he had been killed in the last days of the war. The latter would have been infinitely preferable to his forgetting her, for at least there was some dignity about a dead love, such as Corrine and India Wilkes had, but none about a deserted fiancée.
"Oh, in the name of God, hush!" said Scarlet.
"Oh, you can talk," sobbed Sue Ellen, "because you've been married and had a baby, and everybody knows some man wanted you. But look at me. And you've got to be mean and throw it up to me, that I'm an old maid when I can't help myself. I think you're hateful."
"Oh, hush! You know how I hate people who bawl all the time. You know perfectly well old Ginger Whiskers isn't dead, and that he'll come back and marry you. He hasn't any better sense. But personally, I'd rather be an old maid than marry him."
There was silence from the back of the wagon for a while, and Corrine comforted her sister with absent-minded pats. For her mind was a long way off, riding paths 3 years old with Brent Tarleton beside her. There was a glow, an exultation in her eyes.
"Ah," said Melanie sadly, "what will the South be like without all our fine boys? What would the South have been if they had lived? We could use their courage and their energy and their brains. Scarlet, all of us with little boys must raise them to take the places of the men who are gone, to be brave men like them."
"There will never again be men like them," said Corrine softly. "No one can take their places."
They drove home the rest of the way in silence. One day, not long after this, Kathleen Calvert rode up to Tara at sunset. Her side saddle was strapped on as sorry a mule as Scarlet had ever seen, a flop-eared, lame brute. And Kathleen was almost as sorry-looking as the animal she rode. Her dress was a faded gingham of the type once worn only by house servants, and her sunbonnet was secured under her chin by a piece of twine. She rode up to the front porch, but did not dismount. And Scarlet and Melanie, who had been watching the sunset, went down the steps to meet her. Kathleen was as white as Cade had been the day Scarlet called, white and hard and brittle, as if her face would shatter if she spoke. But her back was erect, and her head was high as she nodded to them. Scarlet suddenly remembered the day of the Wilkes barbecue when she and Kathleen had whispered together about Rhett Butler. How pretty and fresh Kathleen had been that day, in a swirl of blue organdy with fragrant roses at her sash, and little black velvet slippers laced about her small ankles. And now there was not a trace of that girl in the stiff figure sitting on the mule.
"I won't get down, thank you," she said. I just came to tell you that I'm going to be married.
What? Who to? Kathy, how grand! When?
Tomorrow, said Kathleen quietly. And there was something in her voice which took the eager smiles from their faces.
I came to tell you that I'm going to be married tomorrow in Jonesboro, and I'm not inviting you all to come.
They digested this in silence, looking up at her puzzled. Then Melanie spoke. Is it someone we know, dear?
Yes, said Kathleen shortly. It's Mr. Hilton.
Mr. Hilton?
Yes, Mr. Hilton, our overseer.
Scarlett could not even find voice to say, Oh! But Kathleen, peering down suddenly at Melanie, said in a low, savage voice, If you cry, Melly, I can't stand it. I shall die. Melanie said nothing but patted the foot in its awkward homemade shoe, which hung from the stirrup. Her head was low.
And don't pet me. I can't stand that either.
Melanie dropped her hand, but still did not look up.
Well, I must go. I only came to tell you.
The white, brittle mask was back again, and she picked up the reins.
How is Cade?
Asked Scarlett, utterly at a loss, but fumbling for some words to break the awkward silence.
He is dying, said Kathleen shortly.
There seemed to be no feeling in her voice.
And he is going to die in some comfort and peace if I can manage it, without worry about who will take care of me when he's gone. You see, my stepmother and the children are going north for good tomorrow. Well, I must be going.
Melanie looked up and met Kathleen's hard eyes. There were bright tears on Melanie's lashes and understanding in her eyes, and before them, Kathleen's lips curved into the crooked smile of a brave child who tries not to cry. It was all very bewildering to Scarlett, who was still trying to grasp the idea that Kathleen Calvert was going to marry an overseer. Kathleen, daughter of a rich planter. Kathleen, who next to Scarlett had had more beaux than any girl in the county. Kathleen bent down, and Melanie tiptoed. They kissed. Then Kathleen flapped the bridle rein sharply, and the old mule moved off. Melanie looked after her, the tears streaming down her face. Scarlett stared, still dazed.
Melly, is she crazy? You know she can't be in love with him.
In love? Oh, Scarlett, don't even suggest such a horrid thing. Oh, poor Kathleen. Poor Cade.
Fiddle-dee-dee, cried Scarlett, beginning to be irritated. It was annoying that Melanie always seemed to grasp more of situations than she herself did. Kathleen's plight seemed to her more startling than catastrophic. Of course, it was no pleasant thought, marrying Yankee white trash. But after all, a girl couldn't live alone on a plantation. She had to have a husband to help her run it.
Melly, it's like I said the other day. There isn't anybody for girls to marry, and they've got to marry someone.
Oh, they don't have to marry. There's nothing shameful in being a spinster. Look at Aunt Pity. Oh, I'd rather see Kathleen dead. I know Cade would rather see her dead. It's the end of the Calverts. Just think what their children will be. Oh, Scarlett, have Pork saddle the horse quickly, and you ride after her, and tell her to come live with us.
Good Lord, cried Scarlett, shocked at the matter-of-fact way in which Melanie was offering Tara. Scarlett certainly had no intention of feeding another mouth. She started to say this, but something in Melanie's stricken face halted the words.
She wouldn't come, Melly, she amended. You know she wouldn't. She's so proud, and she'd think it was charity.
That's true. That's true, said Melanie distractedly. watching the small cloud of red dust disappear down the road.
"You've been with me for months," thought Scarlet grimly, looking at her sister-in-law. "And it's never occurred to you that it's charity you're living on. And I guess it never will. You're one of those people the war didn't change, and you go right on thinking and acting just like nothing had happened. Like we were still rich as Croesus, and had more food than we knew what to do with, and guests didn't matter. I guess I've got you on my neck for the rest of my life. But I won't have Kathleen, too."
Chapter 30. In that warm summer after peace came, Terra suddenly lost its isolation. And for months thereafter, a stream of scarecrows, bearded, ragged, footsore, and always hungry, toiled up the red hill to Terra and came to rest on the shady front steps, wanting food and a night's lodging. They were Confederate soldiers walking home. The railroad had carried the remains of Johnston's army from North Carolina to Atlanta and dumped them there. And from Atlanta they began their pilgrimages afoot. When the wave of Johnston's men had passed, the weary veterans from the Army of Virginia arrived, and then men from the Western troops, beating their way south toward homes which might not exist and families which might be scattered or dead. Most of them were walking. A few fortunate ones rode bony horses and mules, which the terms of the surrender had permitted them to keep. Gaunt animals which even an untrained eye could tell would never reach faraway Florida and South Georgia. Going home. Going home. That was the only thought in the soldiers' minds. Some were sad and silent, others gay and contemptuous of hardships. But the thought that it was all over and they were going home was the one thing that sustained them. Few of them were bitter. They left bitterness to their women and their old people. They had fought a good fight, had been licked, and were willing to settle down peaceably to plowing beneath the flag they had fought. Going home. Going home. They could talk of nothing else, neither battles nor wounds, nor imprisonment, nor the future. Later, they would refight battles and tell children and grandchildren of pranks and forays and charges, of hunger, forced marches and wounds, but not now. Some of them lacked an arm or a leg or an eye. Many had scars which would ache in rainy weather if they lived for 70 years. But these seemed small matters now. Later, it would be different. Old and young, talkative and taciturn, rich planter and sallow cracker, they all had two things in common, lice and dysentery. The Confederate soldier was so accustomed to his verminous state, he didn't give it a thought, and scratched unconcernedly even in the presence of ladies. As for dysentery, the bloody flux, as the ladies delicately called it, it seemed to have spared no one from private to general. 4 years of half-starvation, 4 years of rations which were coarse or green or half-putrefied, had done its work with them, and every soldier who stopped at Terra was either just recovering or was actively suffering from it. "Dey ain't a sound set of bowels in de whole Confederate army," observed Mammy darkly as she sweated over the fire, brewing a bitter concoction of blackberry roots which had been Ellen's sovereign remedy for such afflictions. "It's my notion dat 'twarn't de Yankees what beat our gentlemen. 'Twas de own innards. Can't no gentleman fight with his bowels turning to water." One and all, Mammy dosed them, never waiting to ask foolish questions about the state of their organs, and one and all, they drank her doses meekly and with wry faces, remembering, perhaps, other stern black faces in far-off places, and other inexorable black hands holding medicine spoons. In the matter of company, Mammy was equally adamant.
No lice-ridden soldier should come into Terra. She marched them behind a clump of thick bushes, relieved them of their uniforms, gave them a basin of water and strong lye soap to wash with, and provided them with quilts and blankets to cover their nakedness, while she boiled their clothing in her huge wash pot. It was useless for the girls to argue hotly that such conduct humiliated the soldiers. Mammy replied that the girls would be a sight more humiliated if they found lice upon themselves. When the soldiers began arriving almost daily, Mammy protested against their being allowed to use the bedrooms. Always she feared lest some louse had escaped her. Rather than argue the matter, Scarlet turned the parlor with its deep velvet rug into a dormitory. Mammy cried out equally loudly at the sacrilege of soldiers being permitted to sleep on Miss Ellen's rug. But Scarlet was firm. They had to sleep somewhere. And in the months after the surrender, the deep, soft nap began to show signs of wear. And finally the heavy warp and woof showed through in spots where heels had worn it and spurs dug carelessly. Of each soldier, they asked eagerly of Ashley. Sue Ellen, bridling, always asked news of Mr. Kennedy. But none of the soldiers had ever heard of them, nor were they inclined to talk about the missing. It was enough that they themselves were alive, and they didn't care to think of the thousands in unmarked graves who would never come home. The family tried to bolster Melanie's courage after each of these disappointments. Of course Ashley hadn't died in prison. Some Yankee chaplain would have written if this were true. Of course he was coming home, but his prison was so far away. Why, goodness, it took days riding on a train to make the trip, and if Ashley was walking like these men... Why hadn't he written? Well, darling, you know what the mails are now. So uncertain and slipshod, even where mail routes are re-established. But suppose he had died on the way home. Now, Melanie, some Yankee woman would have surely written us about it. Yankee women? Bah! Melly, there are some nice Yankee women. Oh, yes, there are. God couldn't make a whole nation without having some nice women in it. Scarlet, you remember we did meet a nice Yankee woman at Saratoga that time. Scarlet, tell Melly about her. Nice my foot, replied Scarlet. She asked me how many bloodhounds we kept to chase our darkies with. I agree with Melly. I never saw a nice Yankee male or female. But don't cry, Melly. Ashley'll come home. It's a long walk, and maybe he hasn't got any boots. Then at the thought of Ashley barefooted, Scarlet could have cried. Let other soldiers limp by in rags with their feet tied up in sacks and strips of carpet, but not Ashley. He should come home on a prancing horse, dressed in fine clothes and shining boots, a plume in his hat. It was the final degradation for her to think of Ashley reduced to the state of these other soldiers. One afternoon in June, when everyone at Terra was assembled on the back porch, eagerly watching Pork cut the first half-ripe watermelon of the season, they heard hooves on the gravel of the front drive. Prissy started languidly toward the front door, while those left behind argued hotly as to whether they should hide the melon or keep it for supper. Should the caller at the door prove to be a soldier? Melly and Corrine whispered that the soldier guest should have a share, and Scarlet, backed by Sue Ellen and Mammy, hissed to Pork to hide it quickly. "Don't be a goose, girls. There's not enough for us as it is, and if there are two or three famished soldiers out there, none of us will even get a taste," said Scarlet. While Pork stood with a little melon clutched to him, uncertain as to the final decision, they heard Prissy cry out, "God Almighty! Miss Scarlet! Miss Melly! Come quick!" "Who is it?" cried Scarlet, leaping up from the steps and racing through the hall with Melly at her shoulder and the others streaming after her. "Ashley," she thought. "Or perhaps... it's Uncle Peter!
Miss Pitapat's Uncle Peter!
They all ran out to the front porch and saw the tall, grizzled old despot of Aunt Pitty's house climbing down from a rat-tailed nag on which a section of quilting had been strapped. On his wide black face, accustomed dignity strove with delight at seeing old friends, with the result that his brow was furrowed in a frown, but his mouth was hanging open like a happy, toothless old hound's. Everyone ran down the steps to greet him, black and white shaking his hand and asking questions, but Melly's voice rose above them all.
"Auntie isn't sick, is she?"
"No'm. She's poorly, thank God,"
answered Peter, fastening a severe look first on Melly and then on Scarlet, so that they suddenly felt guilty, but could think of no reason why.
"She's poorly, but she's plumb outdone with you young misses. And if it come right down to it, I is too."
"Why, Uncle Peter, what on earth?"
"Y'all needn't try to excuse yourselves. Ain't Miss Pitty writ you and writ you to come home? Ain't I seed her write and seed her a-crying when y'all writ her back that you got too much to do on dish here old farm to come home?"
"But, Uncle Peter,
how come you leave Miss Pitty by herself like this when she's so scary-like?" "You know as well as I do Miss Pitty ain't never lived by herself, and she been shaking in her little shoes ever since she come back from Macomb. She said for me to tell y'all plain as I knows how that she just can't understand y'all deserting her in her hour of need."
"Now, hush," said Mammy tartly, for it sat ill upon her to hear Tara referred to as an old farm.
Trust an ignorant city-bred darky not to know the difference between a farm and a plantation.
"Ain't us got no hours of need? Ain't us needin' Miss Scarlet and Miss Melly right here, and needin' them bad? How come Miss Pitty don't ask her brother for assistance? Does she need any?"
Uncle Peter gave her a withering look.
"Us ain't had nothin' to do with Mr. Henry for years, and us is too old to start now."
He turned back to the girls, who were trying to suppress their smiles.
"You young misses ought to take shame, leaving poor Miss Pitty alone, with half her friends dead and the other half in Macomb, and Atlanta full of Yankee soldiers and trashy free-issue niggers."
The two girls had borne the castigation with straight faces as long as they could. But the thought of Aunt Pitty sending Peter to scold them and bring them back bodily to Atlanta was too much for their control. They burst into laughter and hung on each other's shoulders for support. Naturally, Pork and Dilsey and Mammy gave vent to loud guffaws at hearing the detractor of their beloved Tara set at naught. Sue Ellen and Corrine giggled, and even Gerald's face wore a vague smile. Everyone laughed except Peter, who shifted from one large splayed foot to the other in mounting indignation.
"What wrong with you, nigger?" inquired Mammy with a grin. "Is you getting too old to protect your own missus?"
Peter was outraged.
"Too old? Me too old? No, ma'am. I can protect Miss Pitty like I always done. Ain't I protected down to Macomb when us refugeed? Ain't I protected when the Yankees come to Macomb and she's so scared she fainting all the time? And ain't I acquired this year nag to bring her back to Atlanta and protect her and her pa's silver all the way?"
Peter drew himself to his full height as he vindicated himself.
"I ain't talking about protecting. I's talking about how it look."
"How who look?"
"I'm talking about how it looks to folks seeing Miss Pitty living alone. Folks talk scandalous about maiden ladies that lives by theirself," continued Peter,
and it was obvious to his listeners that Pitypat, in his mind, was still a plump and charming miss of 16 who must be sheltered against evil tongues.
"And I ain't figuring on having folks criticize her. No, ma'am. And I ain't figuring on her taking in no boarders just for company, neither. I done told her that. "Not while you got your flesh and blood that belongs with you," I says. "And now her flesh and blood denying her. Miss Pity ain't nothing but a child, and..."
At this, Scarlet and Melly whooped louder and sank down to the steps. Finally, Melly wiped tears of mirth from her eyes.
"Poor Uncle Peter. I'm sorry," I laughed, "really and truly. There, do forgive me.
Miss Scarlet and I just can't come home now. Maybe I'll come in September after the cotton is picked. Did Auntie send you all the way down here just to bring us back on that bag of bones?" At this question, Peter's jaw suddenly dropped, and guilt and consternation swept over his wrinkled black face. His protruding underlip retreated to normal as swiftly as a turtle withdraws his head beneath its shell.
"Miss Melly, I's getting old, I specs, 'cause I clean forget for the moment what she sent me for, and it's important, too. I got a letter for you. Miss Pity wouldn't trust the mails or nobody but me to bring it, and..."
"A letter? For me? Who from?"
"Well, it's... Miss Pity, she says to me, 'You, Peter, you break it gently to Miss Melly,' and I say..."
Melly rose from the steps, her hand at her heart. "Ashley, Ashley, he's dead."
"Norm, Norm,"
cried Peter, his voice rising to a shrill bawl, as he fumbled in the breast pocket of his ragged coat.
"He's alive. Dis yer a letter from him. He comin' home. He... God almighty, catch him, mammy. Let me..." "Don't you tetch her, you old fool,"
thundered Mammy, struggling to keep Melanie's sagging body from falling to the ground.
"You pious black ape. Break it gently. You, Polk, take a feet. Miss Corrine, steady your head. Let's us lay on the sofa in the parlor."
There was a tumult of sound as everyone but Scarlet swarmed about the fainting Melanie, everyone crying out in alarm, scurrying into the house for water and pillows, and in a moment Scarlet and Uncle Peter were left standing alone on the walk. She stood rooted, unable to move from the position to which she had leaped when she heard his words, staring at the old man who stood feebly waving a letter. His old black face was as pitiful as a child's under its mother's disapproval. His dignity collapsed. For a moment, she couldn't speak or move, and though her mind shouted, "He isn't dead, he's coming home," the knowledge brought neither joy nor excitement, only a stunned immobility. Uncle Peter's voice came as from a far distance, plaintive, placating.
"Mr. Willie Burr from Maycomb, what is kin to us, he brung it to Miss Pity. Mr. Willie, he in the same jailhouse with Mr. Ashley. Mr. Willie, he got a horse and he got here soon. But Mr. Ashley, he a-walkin', and..."
Scarlet snatched the letter from his hand. It was addressed to Melly in Miss Pity's writing, but that didn't make her hesitate a moment. She ripped it open, and Miss Pity's enclosed note fell to the ground. Within the envelope, there was a piece of folded paper, grimy from the dirty pocket in which it had been carried, creased and ragged about the edges. It bore the inscription in Ashley's hand, "Mrs. George Ashley Wilkes, care Miss Sarah Jane Hamilton, Atlanta, or 12 Oaks, Jonesboro, Georgia." With fingers that shook, she opened it and read, "Beloved, I am coming home to you." Tears began to stream down her face, so that she couldn't read, and her heart swelled up until she felt she could not bear the joy of it. Clutching the letter to her, she raced up the porch steps and down the hall, past the parlor where all the inhabitants of Terra were getting in one another's way as they worked over the unconscious Melanie, and into Ellen's office. She shut the door and locked it, and flung herself down on the sagging old sofa, crying, laughing, kissing the letter. "Beloved,
she whispered. I am coming home to you.
Common sense told them that unless Ashley developed wings, it would be weeks, or even months, before he could travel from Illinois to Georgia. But hearts nevertheless beat wildly whenever a soldier turned into the avenue at Terra. Each bearded scarecrow might be Ashley. And if it weren't Ashley, perhaps the soldier would have news of him, or a letter from Aunt Pity about him. Black and white, they rushed to the front porch every time they heard footsteps. The sight of a uniform was enough to bring everyone flying from the woodpile, the pasture, and the cotton patch. For a month after the letter came, work was almost at a standstill. No one wanted to be out of the house when he arrived, Scarlet least of all. And she couldn't insist on the others attending to their duties when she so neglected hers. But when the weeks crawled by, and Ashley did not come or any news of him, Terra settled back into its old routine. Longing hearts could only stand so much of longing. An uneasy fear crept into Scarlet's mind that something had happened to him along the way. Rock Island was so far away, and he might have been weak or sick when released from prison. And he had no money, and was tramping through a country where Confederates were hated. If only she knew where he was, she would send money to him. Send every penny she had, and let the family go hungry, so he could come home swiftly on the train. Beloved, I am coming home to you. In the first rush of joy when her eyes met those words, they had meant only that Ashley was coming home to her. Now, in the light of cooler reason, it was Melanie to whom he was returning. Melanie, who went about the house these days singing with joy. Occasionally, Scarlet wondered bitterly why Melanie couldn't have died in childbirth in Atlanta. That would have made things perfect. Then she could have married Ashley after a decent interval and made little Beau a good stepmother, too. When such thoughts came, she didn't pray hastily to God, telling him she didn't mean it. God didn't frighten her any more. Soldiers came singly and in pairs and dozens, and they were always hungry. Scarlet thought despairingly that a plague of locusts would be more welcome. She cursed again the old custom of hospitality which had flowered in the era of plenty, the custom which would not permit any traveller, great or humble, to go on his journey without a night's lodging, food for himself and his horse, and the utmost courtesy the house could give. She knew that era had passed forever. But the rest of the household didn't, nor did the soldiers. And each soldier was welcomed as if he were a long-awaited guest. As the never-ending line went by, her heart hardened. They were eating the food meant for the mouths of Terra, vegetables over whose long rows she had wearied her back, food she had driven endless miles to buy. Food was so hard to get, and the money in the Yankee's wallet wouldn't last forever. Only a few greenbacks and the 2 gold pieces were left now. Why should she feed this horde of hungry men? The war was over. They would never again stand between her and danger. So she gave orders to Pork that when soldiers were in the house, the table should be set sparely. This order prevailed until she noticed that Melanie, who had never been strong since Beau was born, was inducing Pork to put only dabs of food on her plate, and giving her share to the soldiers. "You'll have to stop it, Melanie," she scolded. "You're half sick yourself, and if you don't eat more, you'll be sick in bed and we'll have to nurse you. Let these men go hungry. They can stand it. They've stood it for 4 years, and it won't hurt them to stand it a little while longer." Melanie turned to her, and on her face was the first expression of naked emotion Scarlet had ever seen in those serene eyes. "Oh, Scarlet, don't scold me. Let me do it. You don't know how it helps me.
Every time I give some poor man my share, I think that maybe, somewhere on the road up north, some woman is giving my Ashley a share of her dinner. And it's helping him to get home to me.